Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this, the 22nd day of February 2014. And the telephone number to call in here, 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County or somewhere in this area. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
Anywhere within the sound of his voice.
Or your voice.
Or the radio.
Our voice. The voices of the radio.
That includes the internet.
If you're not listening,
actually,
though,
that was an untrue statement because it is possible to listen outside the United States using the internet. And the 800 number would not work outside of the United States.
That's true, but I invite anyone outside the United States to call that 866 number and tell us that it doesn't work.
I think that is a circular negative logic, but we have caller on 773-1400 who probably makes more sense than you do right now. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing reasonably well. How are you doing?
I hope so.
I'm good. I've been hearing about the economy for so long, and I'm just confused, right?
Join the rest of us.
I know that if I take out loans to support my lifestyle, at some point I have to pay them back.
Yes.
Or
hopefully.
Well, hopefully.
I go into insolvency and I lose everything I could ever have.
Right.
Theoretically. Well,
theoretically,
yeah. So where is the logic? What is the principle and the reasoning behind the country taking out loan after loan after loan to support a lavish lifestyle with no plans to pay it back?
Well, hopefully
we do pay it back. And we are, it makes actually very good sense what we're doing. We have, let me put it this way. It's an important, critical, absolute issue. Macroeconomics. And national debt function very, very differently from personal debt.
I realize that seems strange, but here's a good point to show you. If the United States government had a surplus, and they've had surpluses before, you can pay off you can pay off debt with it. What else could you do with that money? Well, we pretty much said as a people that we don't want the government to buy interest in companies, because that'd be weird. You've got American government owning the countries in the United States.
We don't want them owning any more of anything than they have to.
Right. We don't want them to go out and purchase pieces of debt from other countries. We don't like that. Well, we can lower the taxes at that point. The problem that we see as Americans, for us, we see it as more dangerous if the government has more money than they're spending than if they spend more than they make.
Yeah, when
which is a weird statement, but that's really that's the reality. And
we chose as a nation to cut taxes and raise spending when we had a little bit of a surplus in 2000, right?
Yeah, I think I remember that. I was kind of young then, but
yeah, well, it was under George W. Bush, and it was I agreed with it at the time. We then went into a couple of wars that we didn't fund, and we had some downturns in the economy that we didn't make changes for.
The money is debt, and there's nothing else that seems to be able to function well other than debt for money. You know, people say, well, let's use gold. Well, if you look at the fluctuations in the price of gold, I don't think we want our money fluctuating.
Right. Gold prices in the last 12 months have dropped by more than 30%.
Right.
We don't want that in our economy.
So the point is that, you know, we remember the good old days following World War II when gold was used as the international standard for money, but it was fixed at $35 to the ounce, and you couldn't own gold.
Yes, it was illegal to own gold at a personal level.
And you couldn't sell it at a different price. In other words, total government control of a commodity.
Yeah, I think I remember something about
and
that.
And we certainly wouldn't want that today. Even the conservatives, and this is one of those oddities in history, the conservatives today want the government to run everything.
Which seems funny because they're running on a small government platform.
Yeah, and this is a typical reversal that goes on every few generations where the government, the people who want us to go back to the gold standard, for example, the only way that works is if the government totally controls all gold and silver. And that would mean the government would take over the control of all gold and silver and demand, as they did when we went on the gold standard the first time, that if you own gold bars, you must immediately turn them into the United States government, and you will be paid $35 an ounce for something you paid $1,000 an ounce for.
Right. That doesn't sit very palatably with the folks that have the gold.
So this is the issue. The only viable currency that has ever worked well over a long period of time is debt. So if the United States was to get rid of all of its debt, we would have no money. We did that, by the way, twice in history, and we didn't have any money.
Okay, so debt sets the value of our dollar?
No.
No.
Federal Reserve sets the value of the dollar.
Yeah, and let's come at this from the original question again. Long term, if the government keeps borrowing more than it's making, and it does it
at a
rate that is higher than our growth in the economy, that is a recipe for disaster, no doubt.
Is that what's happening now, or is this actually
not
planned that's what's happening now?
It was happening a few years ago. Right now, we're borrowing as a country. The debt of the country is going up at a slower rate than the economy is growing. And it's kind of like if you go out and you get a mortgage on your house because you want to buy a house. Generally speaking, most people, particularly young people, the mortgage, the loan amount is more than they make in a year.
Yeah.
If you look at the total debt of the government of the United States, it is less than the GDP of the United States for a year. So we're balanced right at that point. So it'd be like if you had $100,000 of income and you had a $100,000 mortgage. Only in this case, the government gets a very, very low interest rate because a lot of people want to loan them money. It is at really, really low interest rates. We're talking about 2.5% to 2.7%. If you could get a mortgage at 2.5% to 2.7%, or you could take your cash that you had $100,000 and buy the house, you've got other things you can use that cash for. It'd be really silly at that kind of interest rate to spend all your cash on the house when you could get a very low interest rate mortgage. Now, I would say pay it down over time, and that implies that the government has some kind of logical, rational plan on how to pay it back, and that's kind of what's being argued about and has been argued about for the past 4 years. The reality is that if we increased our debt at the rate we were doing at the end of the Bush years and the vast majority of the Obama years since then, we would bankrupt the country eventually.
Yeah, but there's another factor here. When the government borrows money, and it doesn't just keep the money.
Correct.
Let me give you an example. One of the major reasons we did not have a depression beginning in 2008, an actual blow-em-out-the-wall depression and a war to follow that we've had in history, is because there's this absolutely huge government expenditure called Social Security.
Yeah.
And the economy may have slumped pretty terribly, and the stock market may have dropped 50%, which it did. But the Social Security recipients, the federal retirees, everybody who had a government-guaranteed income, including the people who had FDIC insurance at the bank, continued to have stable income. And as a result, it was a cushion that was a big piece of why the entire economy didn't collapse.
There were people in their retirement years that were continuing to spend money and continuing to be able to live their lives. If you think of every other depression that we've ever had, that hasn't existed. Those are the people that felt it the worst. And in this particular case, I'm not saying they didn't feel it, but their income did not drop.
Now, you can take that too far and start paying an awful lot of people who probably ought to be working.
Yeah.
Now, that's a problem.
But very frankly, we eliminated about 95% of that, or 99% of it, when President Clinton was president and we cut the welfare rolls.
Okay.
So, there are a few people who are going to be cheating on welfare at this point, but there's a lot more benefit from it at this point than there is loss, and I know a lot of people won't like that. But as I've said to them,
that's not what's being generally
touted
out there.
But the point is, in order to get, let's say you got a mother with two kids, and let's just say theoretically she could have them in daycare and be working, but in fact she finds it better to live at a low standard of living and have her two kids and get her food stamps and whatever else she gets, okay? Now, if you cut her money off, will she go to work? If you cut her money off, all that would happen is her kids would suffer from malnutrition and have mental deficiencies that would hurt our economy for the next umpteen decades.
Here's another social program, and this is one that is fascinating. I am a property owner. I have no children. I pay property taxes. Those taxes are socialized and go to the education of all the kids, even though I don't have kids. And I'm completely in support of that.
I've already paid for my kids. Why should I have property taxes?
And the reason that I'm completely in support of that is when I go to hire someone, I expect them to know how to read and write. I expect them to know how to do some form of mathematics. I expect them.
I don't argue about taxes. I like roads and police and fire departments and things like that.
Right. It's just a question of how much.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It's more like, so the point there is that debt is a good thing as long as we're not just over-ridiculous and we're not really at the point of being over-ridiculous in debt, like way more than we're earning as far as GDP.
Right. Debt is relative.
Yeah.
And the when you look at the debt of the United States, you should measure it the same way you measure all other debt around the country, including personal debt, and that is what's called debt held by the public, not the theoretical debt of what it's going to cost umpteen years in the future.
That would be like saying, I'm having a child, and therefore I now
have to declare bankruptcy.
Because if you think of all the expenses that the child is ever going to incur, college, all school, food, all that good stuff, we're talking about $500,000 before they're 21.
Right. So the point is that if you just look at the debt outstanding, it's 70-some percent of gross domestic product.
Okay.
That's the lowest of any developed country on the planet.
So it's not really this big horrible thing that is being made out to be.
But that doesn't mean that we should rest our vigilance.
No, but we just don't
need to be terrified.
The point is that if we just leave it alone like it is right now and do nothing with it, then probably in about 2 years, the real debt outstanding will start to decline at a pretty high rate of speed. Now, I say this is real after inflation debt. Will start to decline because our GDP will grow in real terms faster than the debt. Now, in the long term,
let's not be fantastical, though. The reality is that things are going to change. If things remained exactly as they were and we didn't have any budgetary changes.
And we don't need wars.
And no wars and no emergency spending or no change to the budget beyond maybe cuts. Then we would start to see the payback very quickly. But the reality is that we have to fight for that every step of the way for the next several years.
And there was one big problem involved with that, and that is the cost of medical care per patient in the United States is literally the highest in the world, and it was rising at about 7 or 8% a year.
That is a lot faster than the GDP growth.
And because we have this thing out there called Medicare, which when you turn 65, the government picks up a big chunk of your medical expenses, we were headed to bankruptcy.
The government would not be able to afford that kind of rate of increase in their debt.
I'm going to tell you something you're probably not going to like to hear, and there's an awful lot of people who are going to see, I can't pull my hair out. I've already pulled it out.
It's all bald.
But I'm going to tell you the truth. The facts of the matter are we passed Obamacare. Our Congress did. The people we elected in the United States passed Obamacare. The president signed it into law. And the next year, medical cost per patient leveled off and has since started to decline. And if you don't believe that, if you think that's false statistics, talk to anybody in the medical field right now and you discover they're no longer on the gravy train.
Right. And that's quite painful in some situations because if you think of that means we have a whole new area that we need to reform because a lot of times the only reason why we thought it was comfortable for a doctor to be on the gravy train is because the initial investment, the amount of money spent on that education is so huge. If they don't get to reap a reward for that, then we're going to lose doctors. So we either need to lower the educational costs, which is another issue altogether.
We're working on that.
Or keep the pay up. Well, you know, so there's going to be some instability in the short term.
Right.
And that is not something that we were predicting that for the whole time period.
I just saw a very good video and then read the article that went with it about a physician who has invented, he got with some high-tech folks, and he invented a thing. You actually set your iPhone into a device that's a little about the size of those batteries or shells that wrap around an iPhone. Mm-hmm. You lay it on your chest, and it transmits your EKG for a computer or a doctor to read without having to go to the doctor. Now, he was saying about how wonderful that was because you don't have to go and, you know, drive in and get a doctor's appointment, and then the doctor says, go get an EKG, and how much more efficient it would be. But, yeah, Jake is doing it right here to some degree.
I don't have an extra.
Yeah, but this is medical standard. It's not actually in, and you're shining a light in my face right now.
There's an app that will measure your heart rate based on your changes in
but this is the EKG color. In other words, and I want you to think about that just a second. That came into existence. First, the technology is there, but secondly, in the cost-cutting environment that he's in, this thing will be snapped up quickly. But what will be the effect of that? The effect of that will be that EKG technicians are about to be out of work. And the very, very, very expensive EKG machines that are sitting in hospitals will soon be shipped off to third world countries as junk. And so this is the kind of thing that's going on in our economy right now, which is one of the reasons we're so optimistic. You don't find it going on in other places. And Jake, last hour, hit it right on the head. Why can this doctor do this? Because in the United States, he has established a patent on this device. He will benefit from this device. If he did it in China, everybody would copy the device and nobody would get anything for it, so he would never invent it in the first place.
Right. There's no incentive to do it. This goes back to what I was saying about we have to take it, we have to reward the incentivize the expenses that go into that kind of education. If we're, you know, we were increasing the costs of medical care at way too quick a rate.
Obamacare actually helped.
Yes. Now, it's got a lot of faults.
Yeah, it has a lot of faults. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be fixed.
And we need to fix it. But right now, unfortunately, the political dialogue is over keep it exactly as it is or destroy it. And that is really unfortunate because it is fundamentally a good idea that just needs some tweaks to it.
Right. There was a Republican alternative that was proposed. The problem with the alternative is it basically ripped the whole thing apart and started with a concept that isn't the same. And this is sad because I think that the Republicans have some amazing ideas here. In fact, the whole idea for this change came from the Republicans.
Right.
Nixon, Ronald Reagan, these are the two people that pioneered the concept.
And then Romney installed it.
Right. And then because it was introduced under a Democratic president.
Well, we're in Bell County. Democrat president. Yeah, okay.
The Republicans cannot support it if they want to get elected. The reality is that a lot of the ideas in the bill, in the law now, mm-hmm. are Republican ideas. We just have to fix the parts that are really broken. And the Republicans are so busy saying, look at all the broken parts, we need to just get rid of mm-hmm. the law.
Well, then let's be fair and equal here. The Democrats are saying this is nirvana.
Right.
Let's not mess with it.
Perfect plan and nothing's wrong with
well,
it.
Well, actually,
there's something in the middle is the reality of there's so many things broken in the plan. We know that. There's so many things that are good in the plan that most people don't talk about.
Actually, it makes a lot of people who are conservatives don't recognize just how unhappy the liberals are with Obamacare.
Right.
They believe the government should be running everything in medicine, and it is just as unpleasant to them as it is to the conservative Republicans. It's just that
they can't say anything about it because the Republicans are being so loud about it.
And they put it together. Now, if we elect a Republican president and we get Republican control of Congress and we tinker with it a little bit and fix it.
Don't repeal it, because will be that will be
then it will be the Democrats who want to repeal it.
Yeah.
And we may get to see that. I don't know. That'll be an interesting
It'd
thing.
Be a lot of fun.
Write that down. If the Republicans take over Congress, this I'm going to tell you, they will not repeal Obamacare.
I want you to recall the last three State of the Union addresses by George W. Bush, where he said, "I want an up or down vote on these judge appointees." And the Republicans at the time were saying, "You cannot filibuster an appointed person. This is wrong in every sense of the way of the word. It's just unprecedented. You can't do it." It's reversed now, where the president is the same statement as saying, "We want an up and down vote," and it's just we're using the same dirty tricks back and forth and back and forth. And that's this.
I'm more of an independent. I'm more of a libertarian, honestly, in my own personal views. I really don't want any kind of supervision. You know, I'm a grown man. I don't want anything. But I think my main worry was, you know, you keep hearing all the terror monger out there, and I sit there and say, well, you know, I've been deployed 3 times. I want to come home and I want to enjoy my country for the next 30 or 40 years.
You will. I'll tell you that the probabilities are extremely high. Well, let me say this. According to the best economic theory, the theorists who forecast accurately the fall of the Soviet Union and all the big things that have happened since, the United States is the most stable, most dominant socioeconomic system in the history of the world, and certainly in the world today. 30 years from now, the United States will still be in that position, barring some totally what we call exogenic event, like a gigantic asteroid smacking down into the East Coast or something.
Or, I mean, it's quite possible. This seems unlikely at the time, but it's quite possible for us to get so polarized that we do something really bad and break something.
Well, I don't think so, because we did that. This is a generational thing, and we are going to break a few things, but the thing about America, which really needs, when we break it, when we come back, what we have is better than what we broke.
Right. And we do replace our government every 2 years in one house, and every
4 to 6 years.
4 to 6 years, we have a completely new government if we want it.
And I've studied a lot of history. I'm writing an extensive academic paper on institutional economics right now.
New institutional economics.
And the more I study this, the more I am convinced that you will be able to enjoy being in the freest, most prosperous system in the history of the world easily for the next 30 years. Now, there's going to be a hiccup about 15 years from now.
There's probably going to be a lot of hiccups,
a big
little hiccups. Between
but you'll do okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That soothes the fears. And at least at this point, somebody actually explained it in a manner that makes sense instead of just throwing out a bunch of catchphrases and oh my God, we're going to die kind of thought, you know.
We don't have, for better or worse, our axes are very, very simple. We simply are here in the interest of hopefully improving factual understanding and logic. We really, a lot of people don't like this, but we are not on either side of the political spectrum.
This is one of the benefits of trying to look at this from an economic perspective, is that we don't have to drum up support. One of the best ways to drum up support is to either scare or inspire. We don't have to do that. What we do is we're trying to say, how do we survive in the current and expected future? In the current times, we know the law that is on the books today. How do we survive in it? How do we prosper? That's what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. Now, in the meantime, if we can give some advice on things that might make things better in the future, that's great. Recognizing reality is what we're supposed to do. And on the political world, it's the opposite. It's how do we change reality to something completely different?
We do have to recognize reality, and reality is that KTEM is a commercial station.
We got to play some commercials.
And we have to play some.
All right. I appreciate the answer and y'all taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
All right. And you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're going to play some commercials here. But on the other side, if you'd like to give us a call at either 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
You are more than welcome to do so. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I got a question. It needs some education. On this quantitative easing, mm-hmm. Can you describe how the money flow works, how the bonds are created, who buys them, how do you unwind from this position and its effect on our market and economy?
Sure.
Sounds dull, but I'll hang up and listen.
You know, right. If I could do that really, really well, I could get like a PhD in a box or something.
Yeah, I can give you pretty good definitions here. Yeah,
go ahead.
All right. At its peak, the Federal Reserve was purchasing every month about $85 billion, that's with a B, dollars worth of bonds on the open market, the secondary market. The type of bonds it was purchasing was about half of that was going towards U.S. government bonds,
mm-hmm.
and the other half was going towards purchasing of mortgage-backed securities, troubled mortgage-backed securities. What does that mean? Well, it means that if you or your 401k management folks or the old lady down the street or the young guy just graduating from high school had a bond from the U.S. government, half of that money could be used to purchase that bond back, and which means that that person then had money in his hands or her hands. The other half was going towards troubled, that's a key word, mortgage-backed securities. By troubled, they had a very clear definition of that. We'll call it the face price, the price of the bond. If you go back to the year 2006 and 2007, and somebody bought a bond, a $1,000 bond, that was mortgage-backed. The way you can tell if it's troubled is if
it's lost a lot of money.
It's not worth $1,000 anymore.
It's worth a lot less than $1,000.
So the Federal Reserve was coming in at the beginning. These things were worth $200, and they started buying them up at about $300. So there was more money coming back into the economy than the face value, the market value on this bond.
If I could interject something here.
Sure,
it's important to recognize that the bank or insurance company or whoever had expended $1,000.
Right.
They got back $300.
Now, over time,
that's like called a $700 loss.
Right. So this is why when we look at the quantitative easing that people have said this is going to cause inflation would be caused if they were buying it back for $1,010 or $1,100, not for buying it back at $300. This is also why the Federal Reserve has shown significant profits over the last several years, mm-hmm. measured in quarters of hundreds of billions of dollars. That profit goes to the federal government. Even though the Federal Reserve is not part of the government, the profits of the Federal Reserve, because it's in an allowed monopoly, mm-hmm. have to be given back to the federal government. This is part of the way that we've been able to spend money when the debt ceiling hasn't gone up, because we're taking profits from the Federal Reserve and using it there.
And by the way, we have, by several multiples, the most profitable central bank in the world.
Right. And if it were Warren Buffett making the same move, going in and sweeping up purchases of $200 or $300 for something somebody spent $1,000 on.
Well, that's what he does. It's called value investing.
Value investing. The thing that's happened here is that the vast majority of those mortgage-backed securities have not failed. Some of them have failed, and the reason why the price was so low is we didn't know which ones were going to fail and which ones weren't. The reality is the vast majority of people that own homes continued to pay for them, even though their credit rating was bad, even though they were underwater on those homes. The vast majority of Americans will still continue to pay their mortgages.
Well, I don't know about the ones in New Orleans who were underwater.
Well, that's a different kind of water.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so that concept is what the quantitative easing was doing. And what that was doing was putting money into the hands of people in the economy. What they were doing with that money in the past, if they'd gotten $1,000 or $300 or something, they may have turned around and spent it. We've got another call waiting, so we know you're there. We'll be right with you. Instead of turning around and spending it, in a lot of occasions, they've used that money to pay off debts, which means that whoever owned, say it's a credit card company, this bank had a loan outstanding, and so this person that owned this mortgage bond got a couple of hundred or $400 back. They turned and they spent the money on their credit card debt. Well, that meant that the credit cards have, if you will, a bond outstanding to the credit card holder. And they're,
you're getting a bit complicated here.
So that got paid down.
Drive off the road.
Right.
Drool
people
all
are
over
drooling
themselves.
All yeah. over. Anyway, that they he wanted to know what the flow, the cash flow is. In a lot of cases, that money, in other cases, not during this time period, that money would have been spent in the economy. It would have caused a big boom. In this particular occasion, it's been used mostly to pay off debt and raise savings.
The easiest way to, for me to understand it, I'm not quite as brilliant as the guy sitting across the desk from me here.
Oh, speak for yourself.
I am.
Oh, you did speak for yourself.
is that when you lose blood, your spleen has been storing blood for a long time, and it releases blood back into the system in a crisis.
Correct.
To replace the lost blood. Now, if it did that when you hadn't lost blood, you would instantly suffer from severe hypertension.
Your blood pressure would go
up. It's called klept something or another, and occasionally pregnant women have exactly that happen, and it can be fatal.
Preeclampsia.
So the point is that in this particular case, the equivalent of 1 year plus GDP of the United States vanished. We were in shock. In using this analogy, we were in shock. And when you're in shock, the best way, if you're in the hospital, to get you out of shock is to
pump some blood in there.
Pump fluid into your system, liquidity into your system.
That's what the Federal Reserve has been doing.
And that's what the Federal Reserve was doing. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jay. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Listen to your program pretty religiously every Saturday. I got tuned in late today, tuned in about a half hour ago, and
probably saved your sanity.
There you go. I just wanted to put my two cents worth in on what I hear a lot of people say, what Jake said about, I own property, but I don't have kids, and I got to pay school tax. My perception has always been, and I wish other people look at it this way, when Jake went to school, when he was 6, 7, 10, 12, 15 years old, he did not pay a penny for his education. The way I look at it, everybody should look at it that they're paying for the education they got.
You got it.
For the
it's
education
true.
That other kids are getting in the future, you're simply paying back for the education you received.
Except
at no cost.
With a lot of interest, because if you calculate the amount of money that it cost to educate me versus the amount of money I have since paid back, I am now well into paying for other people's education.
Yeah, but you boosted the economy.
I have.
Right.
That's why I have no problem with doing it. I think it's a great thing to do. It raises everybody up.
But I'm not talking about college, though. Like I said, you boosted the economy there. But I'm talking about just 1 through 12.
Right.
Yep.
Me, I wish people would look at it that you're not paying for other people's kids' education.
Right.
You're paying for the education you receive.
And there, what you're talking about is something, it's part of the glue that holds a society together.
I agree with that.
And we have it in apparently pretty close to about the right, and we can play with it a little bit, the right amount in that it's called the social contract.
I have to mention something real quick before we get into the social contract.
I didn't make you mad, did I?
No. See, I just, I just saved all of the other property tax money payers a lot of money by not participating for the whole length of my school term.
Yeah, I figured you were going to say something about that. Yeah,
I left the school system when I was 15.
This guy is a high school dropout.
It's a horrible situation to have to, so I have actually, anyway, go back to the social contract.
Well, the social contract is a glue that holds society together, and if it fails, and it can fail in any generation, then that particular society is doomed. It will collapse. It happened in the 1300s. It happened again in the 1600s in Europe. It hasn't happened in the United States, and it doesn't exist in China. As a result, we were talking about last hour, all the things that the reason I'm not concerned about China overtaking us.
Yes.
They have no social contract. There is a population in China significantly larger than the population of the United States whose children are not being educated by anybody except their parents, who generally speaking are illiterate.
The migrant population in China numbers at $314 million by estimate.
Not dollars.
Not dollars. I'm saying people.
You still need uneducated laborers in China, you know, to repair the Great Wall.
Well, but the thing is that when you have, there's no social contract. In other words, they don't owe the next generation anything.
Right. No, I understand what you're saying. No, I never advocate, you know, doing away with the educational
right.
system. In the
but
country.
I'm just saying.
I'm simply saying that you're paying what you have already
mm-hmm.
received. I just
correct.
Think people look at it that way.
Yeah.
There's an argument.
I'm not saying that Jeff was bellyache, but just, I mean, Jake was bellyache, but just people that say that, I wish they would just stop and say, well, you know, I'm simply paying for the education I got.
Right. And to give you an example, there's basically two major experiments, and we're in the middle. Europe is saying you should pay back a lot more than you took out, many multiples of what you took out, and give it to other nations. That's what they believe in Europe with all their heart.
Right.
It's an experiment to see if that works. In China, they say, to heck with that. You keep everything except some of it you give to the government so we can live well. And which is an extremely libertarian form of government.
Which is very strange coming
yeah.
from a purported communist.
Communist, yeah. They control some things, and some things they have. I mean, they don't have Social Security tax over there because they don't have Social Security.
Right.
But,
let me ask you something else.
But in the United States, we're in the middle, and I think we probably are
we're
far
doing a better
closer
job.
To a good route to take.
Right. You said earlier that y'all were basically non-political, especially when it comes to finances and stuff. And I'm sure you have your own. I'm sure you vote, you know, one way or the other. Usually.
Yeah, but we don't make up our mind before we go in.
I think you're pretty much conservative leaning and personal responsibility. And I'm sure that times you probably listen to programs that have talk shows like that, like Limbaugh and Hannity and Levin, people like that. These people all advocate personal responsibility.
Yep.
Well, they.
What I can't understand, one of their spots, if you go out, if somebody goes out and earns $1 million,
mm-hmm.
and they owe $300,000 in taxes, and they don't pay it, then these conservative talk show hosts have these sponsors that come on and say, well, look, if you owe $300,000, we'll get it due down to $10,000.
Right, right.
Well, these people have basically skated on $290,000 that they've
yeah.
spent somewhere. I cannot understand how these talk show hosts that are conservative can advocate a sponsor or have a sponsor that advocates basically irresponsibility when it comes to.
Well, they believe there's basically two underlying philosophy extremes that we don't participate in. One of them is root hog or die, which is the survival of the fittest, and if you can make a
swim
gazillion dollars, that's fine. And on the other extreme is everybody should have equal income, which
living
is,
wage,
which is. You know, I mean, that the extreme position is everybody should earn the same no matter what they do. Now, the issue is we don't agree with either one of those. And I believe that the people that you're talking about, and it's a philosophical belief that says this guy earned all his money, shouldn't give more than a tiny percentage back to the government. The bottom line to it is our current tax law is so structured, for better or worse, and I don't have any real objection to it the way it is right now, so that upper income people pay about half the percentage of taxes that lower income people do. Now, I know that sounds...
We're talking about people that pay the tax. So you've got two people earn $1 million. One pays $300,000 in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy doesn't.
Well, now...
That's just wrong.
If the guy earns $1 million and he pays no taxes because he used the existing tax code, creatively, let's just say for lack of a better term, to legally avoid paying taxes, then that's fine.
No, I'm not saying that they didn't. I'm saying one guy earns $1 million and he pays three. He writes a check at the end of the year for $300,000 to the government. He paid his taxes.
Yeah, I know one of those
guys.
Earns
$1 million. He spent that money in the meantime either on salary for employees or he's bought a house.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
a car.
Right.
And then when the government comes after him. Where's our $300,000? He runs to one of these companies that Limbaugh and Hannity advertise and say, hey, look, we'll get you out of that $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
You won't have to pay $10,000. So the other $290,000, you're still ahead on.
And
that's what I'm talking about.
Now, you're hearing an advertisement for that, but
the
reality is that only applies to people who may have earned $1 million a couple of years ago. They spin it on a bunch of stuff, and if the government came after them and took everything they had, they might get $200,000 back, and they'd have to go to court and fight it out for a long time. So the government, in the interest of efficiency, will cut a deal they'll look at what, because if the guy declares bankruptcy and he doesn't, in, for instance, in the state of Texas, you declare bankruptcy, you can keep an awful lot, and they'll cut a deal with them. Don't assume that just because it's advertised, it'll work.
And also don't, this is a tough one. We don't have any ability to say, go ahead and play these advertisements. We can, if we hear an ad.
Yeah, but they do
there. If we hear an ad and we really disagree with it, we will go to the station and say, don't play that ad on our show anymore. But they still play other ads that we don't get prior approval on them. Now, on the Hannitys, the Hannitys and Limbaughs do get a lot of prior approval, you know, but not all.
They do the advertising themselves. It's not a third-party spokesman. They actually advertise themselves. And to me, that just, you advocate personal responsibility on one hand, then you turn around on the other hand and tell these people a way that they can go to this company and that company and get out of paying those taxes. Well, they'll reduce their taxes. I just can't understand that.
Frankly, I can tell you that I've listened to, particularly Rush, he advocates that somebody else be personally responsible, but not you. And you really, if you happen to be agreeing with him, you can't hear him saying that, but I just listen to what he literally says. And if I could sum up, one of his biggest complaints is people who aren't working who get paid by the government, right?
I kind of agree with that.
And he quotes Mitt Romney, the percentage of people who are receiving money from the government versus the people who are paying money into the government is higher. Well, you know who the greatest chunk of money that is being sent to people who not work are sent, and that's what Mitt Romney was including in his statistics, and which Rush Limbaugh does but he doesn't mention that. That's everybody who's retired.
Everybody that's got Social Security or Medicare coming to them.
Or military retirement, or...
Yeah. It doesn't matter that they paid into it beforehand. If you look at the statistics of people that are just the freeloaders that didn't pay into the system, you've got
a
very, very small number. If you look at the whole thing about the government is paying out, more than 50% of the people in the United States receive a paycheck from the government.
Do you know almost a third of people in the United States are illiterate?
No, it's not a third. It is a very...
More people in China speak fluent English than there are in America.
Yeah, well, there's like, 20% or something.
I think it's right around 12%
of the
United States. And not only are they illiterate, they are completely dependent. Completely dependent on other people for their resources.
That's right. And,
now,
and
most of
and
them
they
are
have
under the
no
age...
freedom to do anything. They're slaves.
They're, most of these are under the age of 7.
Right.
But statistics are dangerous.
Well, you know what they say, the hog always waits at the trough.
Yeah.
Right.
And we really, somebody said we have huge problems. I'm going to tell you,
We do.
I'm in the middle of studying huge problems academically around the world. And I can tell you our problems, A, aren't huge. They're tiny. And B, we are addressing them, almost all of them, quite consistently. There's a few that we're not addressing well enough, but we're getting there pretty quickly.
Yeah, our debates are whether or not we should change the budget to tax people with an additional 1% or 2%, or whether or not we should revise a system that's giving health care to a lot of people that didn't have it before. The debates in Ukraine are at the end of gun barrels. So the size of the problem is perspective for sure. We look over there and say, oh, they're going to figure that out somehow. I'm glad that's not happening here. But when we talk about huge problems, it's only relatively huge. It's huge in that we're talking about budget issues that may be a problem 10 or 15 years down the road. We're talking about...
Jeff something.
Sure.
Jeff, if I remember correct, I may be thinking of somebody else. I hope I'm not. About 15, 20, maybe 25 years ago, did you not have a TV program on cable?
I did. Yes, I did.
I was actually behind the cameras for a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I was.
So what are you asking about the program?
Well, I just always had that in the back of my mind that you did a program at one time, but I was just.
It's called Central Texas Money.
I've been confusing it for somebody else, you know. That
I interviewed business leaders from around Central Texas. I volunteered to do that. It was obviously a PBS kind of station, and I volunteered to do that because I started this in 1991 because we had a supposed depression hit Central Texas when Fort Hood was effectively half of it, one division left and then the other one got deployed. And in fact, what I saw in the actual, real, factual numbers, despite the depression and the people were terrified and all kinds of things supposedly going wrong, sales tax revenues kept rising, which meant that something is working here. So what I wanted to do is bring business leaders on and say, like from managers of HEB that had just opened up and the mayors, and say, what's right about the economy?
And talking to people about what had happened that their business failed. Because the reason why the businesses failed at that point were because they were so afraid that the economy was going bad that they stopped ordering new inventory.
Right.
And then people didn't buy the inventory that they didn't have, so their profits went down.
And it got blown off the air basically because I gave too much good news.
Oh, well, I was going to just ask, what would be the chances of you resuming that program on KHD?
I don't think it would happen. There were some people who were very upset because I had people on there that they, let's put it like this, some people in who had a great deal of authority and power in Bell County got very upset because I had Stu Meyer on while he was mayor of Harker Heights, and he was telling me all the good news about Harker Heights. And I got chewed out for that and told never do that again, and the show got canceled.
I'm not quite understanding the story behind that. Maybe that's a story for another day.
We're almost out of time. There are people who do not want to hear good news on the air, and I didn't have control of it.
Particularly good news about another municipality rather than their own. There is this feeling of competition.
East and West Bell County.
And they're upset with each other, when I think if they just joined hands and got along, then you would have a boom in this. We already have a boom here. If we had a boom from the cooperation of the municipalities instead of the competition, look, there's a lot of other people further away that we can compete with. If we really get our act together in this area, we could be a technological, medical, and in many other ways, foundation that would boost our economy for many decades ahead.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Goodness gracious, has he got a memory? You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and today is Saturday, February 22nd of 2014. We're about out of time for the second hour today of our show. If you'd like to contact us off the air, and you can leave us a message, you know, obviously about what we do, what we say, whatever, we certainly welcome these. We have voicemail waiting on the weekend. There'll be human beings there during the week at 947, which is the only prefix in Salado, 947-1111. And we made that very simple. There's only one prefix in Salado, which I can remember, and then it's 1111.
Yes.
Otherwise,
you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN.
So I could remember it.
Yes. And you can leave a voicemail there during the weekend or talk to a live person during the week in business hours. You can also reach us by email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts if you are so challenged
in
your sanity.
Did you notice that we don't give our address anymore?
We do. We gave a web address.
Yeah, we didn't give our physical address. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Your Fox News station, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.